Breakthrough.
You are now listening to Breakthrough News. It's 5 p.m. You're listening to Breakthrough News, and this is The Punch Out. We're following the news all day so you don't have to, giving you everything you need to know about what's in the headlines and what should be. And yes, we are back with you on The Punch Out for 2021. It is Earth Day, so happy Earth Day to everyone here. We've got plenty for you on the show as always on Thursday. And of course, it is Thursday. Don't forget 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time tonight at BT Newsroom. The Freedom Side will be live. I'll be there with Rania Halleck. But we have plenty for you here on The Punch Out today. We're going to be talking about the hollowness of police department consent decrees. And that's a reference to what's happening right now in Minneapolis with the Justice Department. We're going to be talking about state repression in India. But before we get to either of those important, crucially important stories, we're going to start with today's global climate meeting convened by the United States. Well, 40 world leaders have gathered today, Earth Day, for a global summit, a virtual global summit on climate change. It's called by U.S. President Joe Biden. Now, of course, this is certainly good, not bad, to have everyone together talking about how to solve an existential crisis for all of humanity. Even some of the world's worst climate abusers out there, people like Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil and Narendra Modi in India, also showed up to this confab here. Bolsonaro even showed up with a pledge saying that Brazil would be climate neutral by 2050. So big turnaround from Bolsonaro's usual denialism there in terms of how he's approached the issue. Now, the headline news of the whole thing was that the United States had increased its pledge to cut carbon emissions, now saying that they will cut carbon emissions by 50% from 2005 levels by 2030. Now, some estimates say that U.S. emissions have already dropped about 20%. So essentially, you got about 30% left to go in, 9 years? The U.S. and the European Union both are pledging to reach net zero by 2050, China by 2060. Net zero, of course, is not the exact same as zero carbon emissions, but more or less. Now, there were a range of big-sounding statements made by all sorts of countries. In fact, South Korea, for instance, said they will stop funding coal projects in other countries, although they still use quite a bit of coal. China said that they're going to begin to phase out all coal in about 5 years. Vladimir Putin of Russia gave a notably fact-based presentation pledging reductions of all sorts, although he didn't offer any new targets in terms of what Russia is committed to. Bottom line, though, almost all the world's largest nations and many smaller ones not only showed up, but noted that this is a huge, major challenge, and they all pledged to act. That's certainly a major change in terms of global cooperation to save the planet. The question is, however, will it be enough? And the answer, at least so far, seems to be no. Now, the science behind it all has laid out that if we don't stop global temperatures from rising 1.5 degrees Celsius by 2050, which requires the entire globe to reach net zero carbon emissions by then, that we will have catastrophic climate consequences. Coastal areas wiped out, mass famines, huge increases in extreme weather, which will lead to dislocation, poverty, destruction of crops, and so on and so forth, extinction of species, the catastrophic impact of climate change will hit if we don't meet this goal, 1.5 degrees by 2050, net zero whole globe 2050. Currently, based on the current plans of the various governments at odds here or at play here, according to the United Nations, the Earth is stated to reach a 3.2 degree temperature rise. So we got to limit it to 1.5 degrees. We're slated to go to 3.2 degrees. That's actually over the 2-degree rise that the Paris Climate Accord sought to reach. So even the countries that are claiming that they love the Paris Climate Accords, it wasn't enough then, and we aren't even reaching that goal in terms of where the trend line is. So just on balance here, it's certainly good that countries around the globe are talking about climate change, but so far it seems that their actions aren't really matching their words. There's also another key issue here. Not all countries or all people within countries are created equal when it comes to carbon emissions. In general, the larger the economy, the higher the emissions. But also, the wealthier an individual is, the higher the emissions for that person. So for instance, the wealthiest 1% of the globe accounts for more emissions than the poorest 50% of people on Earth. Wow. The wealthiest 1% of the globe accounts for more emissions than the poorest 50% of people on Earth. China is the world's largest carbon emitter overall, followed by the United States. The U.S., however, is more or less the largest per capita emitter. I think actually Saudi Arabia is technically higher, but very few people there. So that means that the U.S. has the most emissions per person. Now, this has led many experts to say that the U.S. should actually make much bigger pledges, like a 70% cut by 2030. The difference is key. China is a larger overall emitter, but since it's much less per capita, it's actually easier to reduce emissions more quickly through large-scale projects and so on. The U.S. has to address much more directly people's personal consumption levels, which is more challenging. For instance, the U.S. is talking quite a bit about electric cars, which is a huge rollout that could take years, but much less about extensive public transportation in terms of what the U.S. is talking about, which would have a bigger and quicker impact on climate change. But that, of course, requires that people drive less, which is a huge personal change. I mean, the car really runs everything here in the United States. So it would require a bigger, quicker outlay on public transit to get people on board, certainly more than anything envisioned by the U.S. government now. Now, you think about the flip side of that coin in China, which is a newly developing nation, you know, they can set up a subway in a city where almost no one has cars yet. Well, certainly in the past, but where there's not that many people who are driving or whatever it may be. So they're almost like skipping a step in terms of how they're able to do it. So that project is going to have bigger overall impact because you aren't going to have people doing a bunch of emissions in cars and getting out in cars. The U.S. is dealing with the legacy emissions and so has to do bigger changes per capita because people have adopted a standard of living it has such a high individual cost in terms of climate emissions. So all that being said, many of the changes that would have to be made are pretty hard to envision in the time scale required to save the planet. I mean, by 2030, the United States is going to essentially change over all cars to electric cars and build out a massive infrastructure similar to the infrastructure we have around gas stations in order to address carbon emissions, but it's barely going to address public transportation, yet somehow it's going to cut by 2005 levels 50% by 2030. I mean, it just seems to sort of beggar belief in terms of what's really possible there. And the other part of this is that many countries, we're talking about the U.S., but many countries can't afford to take extensive measures because of the inequality between nations, between the global north and the global south. So the issue of climate finance from rich countries to poorer countries to help them adapt is lagging far behind where it needs to be. By 2025, the UN estimates we need to have about $65 billion in climate finance to help poorer nations. The U.S. is struggling to get $2 billion out of the door this year. This is pretty crucial because without climate finance, developing nations could only improve people's lives with the same old energy mix. And of course, this is an equity issue. I mean, you can't ask people to live in abject poverty so, you know, someone else somewhere else can have more energy to live. So at the end of the day, without this climate finance, not only is it going to be harder for people to adapt, but more or less, we could be consigning people to live in abject poverty for even longer by closing off the alternatives in terms of other forms of energy. So a lot of open questions here, and it seems that despite the goodwill, no country in the world seems fully committed to what's required here. And there may be some reasons for that. The obvious one seems to be that the types of changes required to change the planet require big changes in the structure of global capitalism. Something that the backers of most of the governments at today's Earth Day Climate Summit are certainly not interested in addressing. Well, for those who are following India's government and things that are happening there in the subcontinent, one of the things you may have noted is that the ruling BJP party has gained quite a reputation for the political repression of its opponents. For the past several years, and in particular the last year, the government has intensified repression as popular discontent with its policies around COVID-19, around farmers' issues, around workers' issues has been growing really by leaps and bounds. This week, a centerpiece case in the government's mass campaign of repression, the Bhim Corrigan case, seems to be falling apart. The Corrigan case involves 16 prominent activists arrested and charged under the Unlawful Activities Prevention Act, UAPA, and anti-terrorism law. And these, actually, the arrests started in 2018, by the way, and they've been essentially ongoing since then. The 16, which include the world-famous poet Vivara Rao and also other activists and cultural workers, are said to be a part of India's Maoist uprising, and that in particular they were plotting, among other things, to assassinate Prime Minister Modi. In reality, they are being targeted because they were effective advocates for some of the most marginalized communities in the country, exposing the exact sort of conditions that have led to the Maoists being able to maintain a large-scale insurgency for decades. Now, this week, a second forensic analysis of one of the laptops of one of the accused details that the 32 documents that are the centerpiece of the case now, the main part of the case, allegedly showing this conspiracy to commit these various acts, not only are those 32 documents fabricated, but that they were placed on the laptop by an unknown hacker. The Indian government is actually refusing to acknowledge this. They're even saying they aren't even going to go back and look at the evidence or any of the new evidence and check and see if they have made any mistakes by basing their case on these fabricated documents that were placed on the computer by a hacker. And in fact, they seem set to try to keep things going as long as they can. Obviously, they're attempting to disrupt the work of those they hate. Like, for instance, the most recent arrestee, an 83-year-old Jesuit priest named Stan Swamy. He's the oldest person in India to be arrested on terrorism charges. Swamy suffers from Parkinson's disease and requires help to bathe and write letters, as the Washington Post reports. The Post adds further, quote, Swamy lives in Jharkhand, one of the poorest states in India, where he works for the rights of indigenous tribal communities. He has spearheaded campaigns challenging the acquisition of tribal land and the detentions of tribal youths on flimsy or no evidence. End quote. So clearly, when you look at what's happening here, the government of India is looking to send a message to anyone who dares stand up for the rights of tribal communities or other marginalized peoples. That at the end of the day, if you stand up, you can be easily framed and railroaded. Now, how long the case can hold up in India's courts, we're just going to have to see here. But it's important to add this to the list of fabricated charges from the Modi regime that is lashing out in all directions against its critics. Democracy and human rights be damned. The Justice Department has announced that it's conducting a quote-unquote pattern and practice investigation into the Minneapolis Police Department. These investigations often lead to consent decrees between the Justice Department and the local police departments. Basically, it works like this. The Justice Department investigates. They find a bunch of serious issues, pretty much always intense racism and brutality. And then the Justice Department agrees not to sue the police department in exchange for a deal to make changes as part of a court-appointed monitor situation there. The court-appointed monitor will, you know, oversee them as they allegedly make these changes. Now, the whole goal is to allegedly make the police not racist and less brutal through changing policies and procedures within the police department. Consent decrees were one of the Obama administration's favorite tools when it concerned the issue of police terror, or at least attempting to address it, or appearing to address it, maybe is the better way to put it. And the Biden administration had pledged to bring them back. And so here we are. The problem is they don't really work. Honestly, they're more useful for people like me, people reporting on it, than the people in the cities themselves. The reports produced in most of these investigations put hard numbers behind what everyone knows to be true about biased, brutal police practices in cities all over the country. They've exposed how many tactics like stop and frisk are not only racist, but don't actually accomplish any of the goals they set out to. So in terms of making the case against all sorts of police propaganda, they are useful. But in reality, they rarely work in terms of actually changing police behavior. Washington, D.C. is a famous example. The D.C. police went through a consent decree from the late 90s to the early 2000s. Now, we're decades past the end of the court-monitored process, but not only did the D.C. police continue to kill people without justification, but they reproduced their own reports every single year that continue to detail the extreme racial bias in police use of force and police stops. In fact, reported use of force in D.C. has gone up 84% since 2015. 91% of all use of force complaints in D.C. in 2019 were made by Black residents, who are less than 50% of the population. There are other examples of this, of course, Seattle being a prime example. Baltimore and Chicago are in the midst of consent decrees right now, and, well, we see how that's going. Minneapolis, it's unclear what they are even investigating. And Minneapolis itself keeps a range of data showing exactly how racist and bad things are. The Minneapolis Star Tribune reported on this front last year. Quote, the city is predominantly white, yet Black and East African drivers accounted for 78% of police searches that started as stops for moving or equipment violations from June 2019 through May 2020. Whites made up 12% of searches during the same type of stops in that time frame. For Black and East African drivers, 26% of searches resulted in an arrest, compared with 41% of whites. So only 12% of white people are being stopped. 41% of the time they actually have something. 78% of the stops are Black or East African people, really Black people, African-descended people, and only 26% of them resulted in any arrest. It tells you everything you need to know right there. We also know that since the beginning of 2015, officers from the Minneapolis Police Department have rendered people unconscious with neck restraints 44 times. NBC said experts told them that that number was, quote unquote, unusually high. So clearly, we know what's going on here. Consent decrees are a way of really dodging a bullet. Rather than address the actual behavior of police officers, they dance around it. They change policies, procedures, training, but not the unjust laws or the exploitative social context that give rise to the police as an instrument of social control in and of itself, or the deep racism that suffuses the culture of policing. I have to say, the results of the consent decree that will inevitably come in Minneapolis will almost undoubtedly be, in true Biden fashion, that nothing will fundamentally change. And that's going to do it for us here today on the Punch Out 422 2021. We will be live tonight, 8 p.m. Eastern, on the Freedom Side at BT Newsroom, across all your social media platforms, youtube.com/breakthroughnews. We'll be back with you tomorrow with more from the Punch Out here on Breakthrough News.